Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
It's been a contentious issue, the relationship between the province of British Columbia and the federal government over the issue of health care funding.
A group of activists trying to bring solutions to BC's family doctor crisis was on the West Shore today trying to get the premier's attention.
And the premier seems to have his attention attracted.
With the greatest respect to the federal ministers who are now suggesting that everything is fine, go and talk to human beings. Go and talk to patients, go and talk to healthcare providers, and they'll get a different message.
Meanwhile,
what disappointed me was his federal ministers basically sandbagging us as we're gathering, saying, oh, well, I don't know what they're talking about. We get along really well. I got a call, Al, on Sunday morning at 8 o'clock from the Intergovernmental Affairs Minister saying, how are things going? And I thought, well, what do you think, bud? I've been trying to talk to you for a month and a half, and you phoned me on the eve of a meeting to say, I hope everything's all right. I mean, that's not collaboration. That's not working together. That's trying to cover your backside.
Now, despite the seeming acrimony between the province of British Columbia and the federal government over healthcare funding, the fact remains that nearly 100,000 people here in our community are estimated to not have access to a family doctor. The opposition BC Liberals, meanwhile, have a 30-day action plan that they are proposing to better support the doctors we have and retain them in our system. Joining us to talk more about this is the opposition leader of the BC Liberals, Kevin Falcon. Kevin Falcon, good morning. How are you?
I'm very good, Adam. How are you?
Oh, you know, I'm just trying to keep up with all the back and forth in this. There seems to be quite a lot of acrimony between the provincial government and the federal government over this one. I think many British Columbians, Kevin Falcon, don't really care whose fault it is. They care whether or not they have a doctor. What can we do about this?
Well, you know, first of all, I got to tell you, if I was the federal government, I doubt I would give any more money to this government either. Because frankly, they haven't even got a plan. They haven't put a credible plan forward on what they're going to do with those dollars to give the confidence to the public or the federal government that they're going to actually spend them wisely. You know, throwing more money into this alone is not going to solve it. We have problems go well beyond that. And one of the reasons we put out 30 days ago a 30-day action plan for this government was because I genuinely think they don't know what to do. And this was a 30-day plan that was informed by our discussions with family doctors and frontline workers that basically offered up some pretty basic things to help staunch the hemorrhaging of family physicians that are fleeing family practice and going into other forms of medicine or even leaving the province. And they didn't react or respond to any of those suggestions. And so now we put out another call 30 days later to say, look, here's some more steps you can take to get more internationally trained physicians into the province of British Columbia quickly that can help deal with the challenges we're facing. And by the way, most of those international medical graduates, Adam, are Canadians. They've just studied abroad in places like Australia or Ireland or the United States, and they're quite willing and eager to practice here. They just can't get the funded seats necessary so they can come here and do their residencies.
What? Hold on. So these are Canadians who just happen to get their training in another jurisdiction like Australia.
Absolutely.
They want to use
absolutely
that training to help Canadians, and they can't?
Absolutely. I'll give you a good example.
Please.
There was the doctor shared with me. There is a young woman who's now practicing in Nanaimo.
Yeah.
She graduated from Harvard Medical School,
wow,
one of the top medical schools in the world.
Yeah.
It took her 3 years before she was able to get a residency to practice in BC. She's now...
Huh. 3 years.
Acceptable. It's just an unacceptable situation.
Kevin Falcon joining us, BC Liberal leader. That sounds like a little bit of a shaky cell line there. Sir, are you able to hear us? All right. I think we may have a little bit of a connection problem there with Kevin Falcon. If Kevin Falcon is able to hear us... Are you able to hear us, Kevin Falcon?
Yeah, I can.
Oh, there you are. Sorry about that. It was, yeah. So you said, so Harvard Medical, and it takes 3 whole years for her to be able to get a residency here. How do we fix that?
That's right. So what we've asked for today is to expand the number of residencies that they've got in British Columbia, which right now is at 56 seats. We're saying immediately increase that to 150. That would allow a bunch more doctors, most of them Canadians, by the way, that have trained abroad, to come. And these are all doctors, by the way, that have passed their what they call their Medical Council of Canada qualifying exam. So they're highly qualified.
Mm-hmm.
They want to practice here. but there's not enough funded seats to get them here. And so what we said is increase that to 150 immediately, and let's get them trained up. There's lots of programs that we have already existing in family practice training, including at Surrey Memorial Hospital, including on the island, including up in the University of Northern BC, where we can get them working with practicing physicians now so that they get trained up, and in 2 years, they can be out there practicing medicine full-time as family physicians.
Kevin Falcon, as I'm sure that many audience members would point out, the issue of family doctor access has been one that the BC Liberal government before the NDP also struggled with, and you know because you were around for much of that.
Absolutely.
However, despite things not being quote-unquote fixed during the BC Liberal years, I think it's fair to say that I have never seen people lose access faster than they have under this NDP government recently. So surely there's something that we can do better.
Well, yes. Well, first of all, it's important that you understand something. We were never perfect in government, believe me when I tell you that, and no government ever is. But one thing we did do very early on, in fact, in 2002, is we more than doubled the medical training spaces for doctors in BC from 128, which existed when we inherited government from the NDP, to over 288. Okay, so that's more than doubling it. Now, here's the problem. This current government's now in their second term. They're in their fifth year of power. They have not added one single medical training space in the province of British Columbia. And, you know, that's part of the problem, as you'll see in our release, that we've also called for expanding the Canadian medical training program at UBC from the current 288 to 400, so that because we have to flood the zone with way more doctors.
Yeah, we do.
If we are going to break the back. Right now, one out of five British Columbians cannot access a family physician, and when they go to deal with walk-in clinics, they're facing the longest wait times in Canada. So it's just an untenable situation that has to change.
Healthcare workers, I'm reading in the release here, are struggling in an overwhelmed and understaffed system. And I hear from them, Kevin Falcon. I get texts from them. I get calls from them sometimes. And I get the sense that it's even worse than the general public knows. How fast could these changes be implemented, and will they be?
These changes could be implemented very, very quickly, and that's part of what frustrates me so much. There's no sense of urgency in this government to deal with the crisis. It's not when I listen to John Horgan complaining about how the federal government isn't going to write him a blank check, I'm just like shaking my head. Like, are you kidding me? You know, if you're going to have any credibility with the federal government to go and ask for more money, go to them with a plan. This program I'm talking about in terms of expanding the international medical graduate funded seats, the residencies, they call them, the federal government will fund half the cost. They've got a program in place that they announced in the last election to help fund training up of more physicians. Great. Here you go. This is the opportunity to get 50% of the cost funded by the Fed. And it's a plan. It's a credible plan that any government would say, yes, we'd love to sign on to that. What we need is leadership. Leadership that doesn't sit around whining and complaining that the federal government's not writing them a blank check, but gets on with fixing the program. Well, I can tell you, I've been traveling all over this province. I met with a doctor in Williams Lake. He's been a practicing family physician for 41 years.
Yeah.
And he said, Kevin, I have never seen the healthcare system as bad as it is today. It is that much of a crisis. And we need some sense of urgency out of this government to deal with these things.
Yeah. Kevin Falcon, BC Liberal opposition leader, presenting yet another plan to help try to retain and support the family doctors that we have still able to work in the system. Crisis is a term that I'm hearing used much more commonly now to describe the healthcare system overall than I think at any point in my career. Kevin Falcon, thanks for your time. As always, great to talk to you. Any final thoughts?
You bet. Well, just I really hope that the government, you know, just develops some sense of urgency around this, Adam, because I can tell you, lives are literally being lost right now in our healthcare system, and it really concerns me. I'm telling you, if this government would just travel around the province a little bit and talk to family physicians, as I have done in every part of this province, they would realize just how serious a problem we have right now and how we need some sense of urgency out of this government to deal with this, because I am very, very concerned about the almost 1 million British Columbians who do not have access to a family physician. I just was talking to a reporter not 10 minutes ago who said she can't get access to a family physician.
Yeah.
And when you develop these problems and you've got no one there to help you and guide you through the system, that is it's a crisis.
Yeah, we're letting them down, those million people. They deserve better from us, and we need to do a better job. So I'm glad to hear you advocating for this.
Right.
I want to see the government on side. I want to see everybody on side, because we can fix this.
We can. I agree.
Kevin Falcon.
Get her done.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Adam.
All right. Bye now. There we go. BC Liberal leader Kevin Falcon calling the government to account, and I think all of us are calling the government to account. Don't tell me it's impossible to fix this. We know we can have a functioning family doctor system because many of us remember when we used to have one. Now, I know it might not be easy to get back to that, but we know it's possible. We know it can be fixed. Therefore, we can fix it. Let's get the job done. 1 million British Columbians deserve a lot better, and we can give it to them. We just have to find within ourselves a strength of will to do what is necessary. I heard some great suggestions today. I hope that they get enacted sooner rather than later. Quick break. Back after this.
You're listening to Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Yeah, I know all these people are there. But the BC Liberals didn't get everybody a family doctor as well. I know, this is how politics works, though. We got two main teams. Everybody knows it. The Greens were a force to be reckoned with Andrew Weaver at the helm. I personally like the remaining Green MLAs, but in terms of those who have the clout to actually hold the Horgan NDP majority government, which, by the way, I've actually been a fan of a lot of the stuff that they've done. Not all of it, of course, and you all know that. I've been critical of that. To account, it's going to be the BC Liberal opposition. They know what it takes to be in government. They've been there. And quite frankly, despite the issues with family doctors not being solved, per se, during the BC Liberal reign, it was amazingly well done compared to what we've had happen since then. And you all have to admit that. The family doctor situation has worsened further and faster under the current government than probably any government in recent memory. Yeah, I know we went through a pandemic. It's all we ever hear about. I get that. But there's got to be a way to at least halt this decline, and there's got to be a way to pull out of this nosedive. And if it takes the opposition holding the government to account and maybe hurling some criticisms at it that it feels a little too sharply, then good. That's how the system's supposed to work. Criticism is supposed to be the way that we hold those who otherwise have power over us and ultimately make the final decision with respect to laws and legislation to account. That social censure, that human inclination to want to be liked and to want to avoid being disliked, that is a natural check and balance that we have in any democracy, which is why a fundamental right that all citizens need to have is the ability to criticize their government. It's a right that I exercise regularly in the public interest on these airwaves, and it's a right that you can exercise as well. No, I don't block highways to make points. Adam, you don't support protest when it's a blocking. Yeah, we know. We know I don't, because I don't support other citizens being roped into it. But the ability to critique, to hold to account, you better believe I'll defend your right to do that. It's like Voltaire said. Well, I may not believe what you say, I will defend to the death your right to say it. Voltaire actually had a lot of sayings that I love. Said, what was it? It's like, dear Lord, if I am to have adversaries, please ensure that they remain ridiculous. And that one seems pretty pertinent too most days. All right, let's go to Lynn on open lines, 250-386-1161. Hey, Lynn, how you doing?
Hi, I'm doing well, thanks. You just made me laugh. So I just wanted to call in and speak a little bit about the missing middle housing issue, which is the hot topic.
Yeah.
So first of all, it's extremely concerning that this has become about, or it's been made to look like it's housing versus anti-housing.
Yeah.
Because that's not what the situation is. Yeah. And so I want to share you just a little bit about my circumstances.
Okay.
So I live on a fairly small street in Gonzales with a cul-de-sac that comes off the street.
Yeah.
On the cul-de-sac, there are 8 houses. Two of them are part of a duplex, and there are 2 suites. On the cross street, there are 14 houses. I just did the math here.
Yeah.
And there are 6 suites. One of those houses is a duplex, and 2 of the suites are in the duplex.
Okay.
Most of these are older homes, 1950s, 1960s. They would be considered single-family homes. There's only, I think, maybe 5 of them that would have been built after 1980.
Okay. So relatively, they're at the point where they're getting old, they're showing their age, but there's character in homes like that. Now, some folks might want to knock them down, but not everybody.
Yeah, so that's not the point, though. Is there's, out of those houses on the street that I live in, mm-hmm. 5 of them are rented.
Hmm.
On the street, the cross street, there's 6 suites and at least 2 of them that are rented, the houses that are rented.
Yeah.
So there's a number of tenants.
So where would they go if those got sold for missing middle? Don't know.
Exactly. So okay. when I bought my house, I didn't just go and buy a house. I was, you know, in a situation where my house, where I was living, the suite I was living in, it was sold out from underneath me. And so I was in a panic and thought, you know, I never want to be at the mercy of a landlord again. I actually collaborated with a friend because we were both in a situation where neither of us could afford to buy a condo and pay the strata fees. So we bought a half duplex with a suite in it and combined our resources. Now, he doesn't live here anymore. It was a friend. Like, it wasn't a romantic relationship. It was two suites. But we now rent his suite out to a tenant. So I live in a half duplex with a suite in it, and my neighbor has a half duplex with a suite in it. So we actually have a fourplex. We've created this scenario on our own.
You are the missing middle, and you did it before anybody made you.
Middle. And what I could tell you is that if we weren't living here and we were waiting for a developer to build us a fourplex, none of the people that live here now would be able to afford to live in any of those units.
Yeah.
I can tell you that, you know, of these neighbors I'm talking about, I have the phone numbers and on a first name basis with 11 of them.
Wow.
We have a very tight community.
Yeah.
So we know who's renting. We know who's who. I'm not making up this stuff.
No.
And I can tell you that, you know, there's a young couple across the street that really wanted to try and get into this market. The only way they're ever going to be able to do it is if they could buy something with a suite, which would enable them to sort of own something and provide a rental at the same time, somewhat like, you know, some of the people on the other side who are all rah, 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 missing middle, but actually have a house with a suite in it.
Yeah.
If they are forced to, if they're not able to do that and they have to compete with a developer and their only option is to buy an expensive townhouse, they're done.
Yeah.
They are not, there's no, just because so you can displace them just because you build a $900,000 or $1 million townhouse that, yes, is less than a single family home, doesn't mean that that family that's renting that house is suddenly going to be able to afford to live in that. We have one family on this street that's been living here for 27 years renting.
Wow. I'm just trying to think of what the property values would have been 27 years ago. So that would be back in like 1997. Yeah.
So with the rent restrictions, that family would be having pretty good rent right now.
Yeah.
So at some point, you know, maybe the owner's going to look at this and go, well, I can't increase the rent anymore, so maybe I'll just sell to a developer. And the easier they make that, the more likely that's going to happen.
Yeah. And the owners, you know, they'll cash in with the appreciated gains. And, you know, and they have every right to do that, owning a position in the market. But if we're doing this to try to provide housing to folks who can't afford housing and we end up displacing more folks than we actually house, at least in the short term, to me, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, I own, you know, a half a house.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, I have a little bit of equity, but there's no way that I would be able to afford to buy anything that's being built in this neighborhood, and I own part of my home. I'm not starting from scratch. You know, and I've got to say, you know, I've got friends that have been dem evicted, and what went up in its place was, yes, a lot more housing than was originally there, and yes, they were living in a crappy house, but what ended up going up, they can't even afford to live in a one bedroom in that place, and they had a three bedroom house.
Yeah.
Now they're paying, you know, I would say probably 30% more than they were paying in the house that they were living in. And, you know, and then on top of all of that, I take issue with the Coriolis report and some of the numbers that have been provided and, you know, that this notion that it's not economically viable to do this or contribute to the affordable housing.
Well, the report does
provide affordable housing.
It says that there are parts of the city where it could be more viable than others, though, doesn't it? In the Coriolis?
But you know what? I don't believe the numbers
because
I can show you examples of where it's been done, and based on the numbers in the Coriolis report, it would be impossible.
Interesting.
Like,
so
that they're saying they have.
Okay. I'm almost out of time. I have to run, Lynn, but I want to say thank you very much for this. this, and we're going to continue this conversation. And anything that you want to contribute to the program, or you know, people send me emails sometimes. Anything you want me to look at, always happy to do that. All right.
Okay.
All right. Perfect.
Thanks very much.
All right.
Okay, thank
Have
you.
A great
all
day,
right.
Lynn. And that goes for anybody out there who wants me to take a look at any report, like the Coriolis report, or anything on like that. Like you can email me. It's adam.sterling@bellmedia.ca, and I'd love to continue this conversation. And I've got 4 seconds left, and Mar Gardner is going to be up right after the break. And I'm looking forward to talking to her as well. So don't go anywhere.
Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
We've had a few people call into the show recently and announce that they were running as candidates for City of Victoria Council. Steve Hammond did it. Gary Beyer did it. Janice Williams did it on July 14th.
Our family lives here. Our business is here. This is our home. There's a lot at stake here. I love this place, and I've got a lot to lose. And I think a lot of candidates with a lot to lose go, holy moly, I've got a lot to lose.
And you do, because once you jump into the game, the attacks, they are vicious, and they come from all corners. But
I've got to stand up for this community. I've got to put my name forward. I've got to be brave. And I've got to hope that other people look at that and go, you know what, I can do the same thing.
And I'm hoping other people have looked at that, because Janice Williams has faced no shortage of adversity since she announced her candidacy to seek Victoria Council. Another person who I've been watching very closely, who we have been in continuous communication with during the unfortunate failure of the 24/7 camping policies in Beacon Hill Park and elsewhere, as well as what many came to call the crime wave, which was a combination of the repeat offender problem as well as strained resources combining with camping, causing crime and disorder to radiate outward from Beacon Hill Park during the earlier parts of the pandemic. Among those who has felt the impacts of those city policies most sharply was Mar Gardner with the James Bay Neighborhood Association. She's also the chair of the CALOC, the Community Association Land Use Committee for that neighborhood association. And a website went live last night declaring her candidacy to seek a seat on Victoria Council in the coming October 15th election. Mar Gardner, how are you doing?
Fine, Adam. Thank you very much. And yes, the website went live as we were trying to test it, then all of a sudden it came live, so we had to leave it off.
It was a perfect week. It was a perfect week, Marg, with all the stuff that we've seen in terms of the, because the online discourse has been pretty rough, and I know that you've been monitoring a lot of that, and you were in that public meeting last week with respect to the some of the acrimony that flew back and forth, and you were the first speaker. By the way, I just want to say that was a lovely painting that I think that you included. It was such a nice painting. It was your grandchild and the home that he lives in, that some people might call a mansion, but it's him and it's other families as well in that structure. For those who might have missed that, tell us that story.
Yeah, and it's, I think it's important to realize, like, with three households there, it really actually wasn't a mansion, but it's also one of the busiest streets in Vancouver, so it's not in a secluded little area.
Yeah.
It's, and that's why they built a fence, so they had the little narrow strips so they can at least play catch.
Yeah, but I think that it's so important, because that example that you offered to us sort of changed the way I had been looking at the missing middle policy debate that we've been having here in Victoria, in terms of us sort of jumping the gun and making assumptions as to what the status of things is now that, quite frankly, are not accurate and don't reflect the situation. Talk about your position on that policy.
Well, the blanket policy, first of all, doesn't meet most of the city objectives, especially in the official community plan. But also, in that picture of that house that I painted for my grandson, there's a diversity. It's a strata complex.
Yeah.
One group, my family, is occupying their part. The other two are being rented out, which means you have a diversity of income.
And
types of housing. You also have an age spread from 2 to about 75 in the same housing complex. So it provides a diverse type of housing in neighborhoods, and actually makes for, I think, a really nice mix of people in a neighborhood. But going back to it, my presentation, the last slide, I realize you appreciate, but my presentation was really done to show, if people want to look at it, it shows the context of what planning's all about in our city and how we fit into the region.
Yeah.
And I think that that was not shown in a lot of the information that was presented for this initiative. And we have to remember that. because we're only a little, 12 square kilometers of land. And so we have to remember that. And I think that that context wasn't given to people during the engagement PR process.
Yeah.
And it's important.
I was really surprised, and if I'm recalling it, please correct me if I'm wrong, but there's only one R1 zoned area in James Bay, and it's McDonald Park.
I was wrong.
Oh, okay.
The big one R1 zone is McDonald Park.
Yeah.
But there's a little laneway called Alma.
Okay.
Most people don't even know about, and it's got a couple real small ones that have been converted. We're talking one of these laneways with tiny houses.
Yeah.
And it was also R1, but converted type of thing. And so there were a few other ones which I wasn't aware of, and someone brought to my attention. It was so small on my map, I needed a magnifying glass to see it.
Fair enough. So I want to ask you about this council run, because you have, I think, been subjected, and you personally, you've told your stories on these airwaves before, to some of the impacts of Victoria Council's policies. And you, like everyone else, were effectively locked out of City Hall for the first year or more of COVID-19. Now, you were back in City Hall a week and one day ago with others, finding your voice, speaking, being heard. Talk about why now and why it's important for you to seek a seat at that table.
I think now is because we have lost real direction. We have such division, and people have been pitted one against the other because of the way that things have gone forward in the way of special interest groups having sway more than general public interest, and that really has worried me. And I think something that's important is, and my theme of my campaign is, think local and act local.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, stay in our own lane. The official community plan is actually the social contract between the city and the people they serve. And that contract, I think, is no longer solid, and it's twisted and needed repair. And that meeting last week was actually to do a blanket zoning of the social contract.
I wanted to ask you your thoughts on a couple of the contentious issues that we've looked at going forward, because I know you've talked about your concerns about, the 24/7 camping policy was one of them. What are your thoughts on Beacon Hill Park in general and the closures that we've seen there? Do you have a position on that?
Well, first of all, the camping's still going on, quite a bit of it, and I've been relaying some of that to bylaws in the last couple of weeks in
good
Beacon
point.
Hill Park.
Yep.
But the closures, I think some of them are more of a pretense, and we have to relook at that. We do need the closure that was originally in there for sure. We can't have people using Beacon Hill Park as a shortcut for driving quickly. And so that is very bothersome. Now, I think we have to look at it more broadly. Now, myself, when I've had people visiting who couldn't walk, say, two blocks because of their health situation, frankly, I used to park and drop them off where the pickleball courts are, because that was a place where they could go to where it's so pleasant to see, which is Goodacre Lake and the garden area near the washrooms.
Yeah. What about Clover Point?
I think we have to rethink it, but again, we have to look at it again without the lens of one interest or another.
All right. What about Clover Point? You want to open that one back up?
Not to the way it was, but
no.
We need to consider it. We have to look at all the information.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's been a lot of contentious talk about it for different ways.
Yeah.
But we really have to look at it. Now, I've stayed out of that because it was not in James Bay.
Fair enough.
But
if you're on council,
but I need to see the information that already exists, which I don't have right now, because there was community input and other things, and I haven't read it all. And so it would be my intent to actually be informed.
Okay.
And part of my presentation last week was to show what kind of information is needed when you make decisions. You need real information, not just anecdotal, although anecdotal is information, but you have to not get sideswiped by one person's experience. You have to actually look at the information needed to make a decision. And this one, it's community space and how it can be used best, and the public interest should be upfront.
Speaking of specialized knowledge in one particular area of the city, I know that you have talked about the potential introduction of a ward system in the past. Talk about that.
Mm-hmm. What I saw when I first moved here, I could see some dysfunction. So I'm not talking about the current council.
Yeah.
And I saw that it was very difficult. As I saw special interests getting sway, and it doesn't matter what special interests, but many of them, where residents' well-being was not always up front.
Yeah.
And I have lived in other cities with a ward system. And a ward system means you have a much more compact area, and you have a real representative that represents you. What we've seen, especially in the last year, was counselors, not always, some were particularly advocating for one neighborhood, and other people really felt that they weren't being listened to, not even listened to, that's not the right word, that the concerns weren't really up front. I think it's important, Adam, to realize most people don't want to be heard. In other words, they want to live their lives in peace, and they don't want to be fighting City Hall. They just want to live their lives with very good infrastructure around them.
All right. Mar Gardner throwing her hat into the ring for Victoria Council. You, of course, have done this before. You ran last time in 2018. You had, I believe it was over 7,000 votes, just a couple thousand shy of what the cutoff was for the top eight spots on council. I know you have that notoriety. Talk about how you expect your campaign to unfold.
I'm not sure how it's going to, but I'd like to say a moment about what happened after that election.
Yeah.
Tell you how I work. And that is after the 2018 election, the three Together Victoria candidates won.
Yeah.
And I knew I would be working with them for 4 years, so I reached out. I initially asked for Laurel Collins to be the liaison for James Bay.
Yeah.
And then I spent 50 to 60 hours preparing and discussing issues with the three new Together Victoria candidates.
Wow.
They were elected. I was going to go work with them because I was working forward for the interests that are, you know, for my own neighborhood. And that is the objective that that's the approach I take forward. And I think you will realize a lot of people disappeared after that election, but I stayed because I'm committed. Now, in the election coming up, I'm not too sure which way it will go because there's so much social media now, which really wasn't that activated 4 years ago.
Yeah, it's really something. Like, I know you've probably seen the stuff that's happening to Janice Williams, and I've seen you mentioned, of course, in terms of your appearance at Victoria City Hall last week. I think you got a lot of folks talking. I'm seeing a lot of support as well. I want to be very clear about that. Is there anything else that you want to leave with us for the moment? Mark Gardner throwing your hat into the ring once again for the 2022 October 15th general election.
Well, I think it's just that I've never been an activist, but I've been an advocate. And as a prairie person, I do things. I just don't talk about them. And the role of the city council will take me back to my earlier life when as a regulatory officer in the federal government and as administrator of a university, my role is to safeguard and promote public interest. And that's where my real interest lies. And I believe I can really assist in that role. And I will also, because we're going to have such a turnover in council no matter what happens, I think I would bring a different sense of a corporate memory and understanding of what has happened, and because I've been also working with land use for 10 years.
Absolutely. And that's very, very important, the institutional memory of not only council, but also your role in the James Bay Neighborhood Association and on the Community Association Land Use Committee. It's important that we have as much experience and knowledge at that table as we can. And I do think have you been endorsed by Jeff Young? Did I read that on your website?
Yes, you did.
So Jeff Young is endorsing you. That's a big name endorsement.
So is Shelley Gudgeon.
And Shelley Gudgeon, former counselor for the city of Victoria, too. So you've got endorsements from Jeff Young, from Shelley Gudgeon. Where can people go for more information, Mark Gardner?
Well, my website wasn't quite finished when we were launching it for testing, so there'll be a bit more change. But it's just margardner.ca, www.margardner.ca. No punctuation between the Marg or the Gardner.
All right, www.margardner.ca, the newest candidate to announce for the October 15th municipal election. Mark, great to talk to you as always, and we'll be watching your race very carefully.
Thank you very much, Adam.
All right.
Good luck to all.
All right, absolutely. Go get them and have a great day. All right, we'll take a quick break. 250-386-1161. Open lines after this.
Keeping you informed, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Hi, Adam. A texter writes at 107010. What evidence is there that the missing middle scheme is not a plan to create chaos like 24/7 camping? I think we're all missing the point. If a dozen people get dem evicted, it'll be chaos and become pressure on the province. Texter, well, let's think about this. Who was in favor of 24/7 camping? We don't see the same alignment at the council table. Dubo and Isit, of course, the loudest voice in favor of 24/7 camping. Both of them are against the Missing Middle Housing Initiative passing as it is. Isit keeps trying to change it to inject more affordability provisions as well as other potential changes, and Dubo has concerns about tenants getting displaced. And I actually think that the more I think about it, the more I am convinced that the displacement issue is the most important one if we are doing this to help the housing insecure in the middle of the housing crisis. If we're doing this because, you know, there's no time like the present and older buildings need to be torn down, we need to create more housing stock for the future, because there should still be availability gains in terms of just there being overall housing in the market eventually. What I am suggesting is that the unique market conditions that we are faced with at this time mean that we won't see those benefits right now. It'll probably take years for them to actually filter through. And my question is, what happens to desperate families at their wits' end right now during that transition phase? Like, even if they built the houses instantly, and even if they were afforded or affordable, or I should say they can't build the houses instantly, but even if they were affordable, you'd still have those families displaced for the moment. Where are they going to live? And I don't know what the answer is. I don't think there is one. And that's my primary concern. If we are doing this because of the housing crisis, we shouldn't be displacing people at the worst point in their lives. Like, that's just common sense. If we are doing this for many other reasons, and incidentally some folks get displaced, that's a different argument. But that's not the argument I'm hearing. I'm hearing every argument, it feels like, instead, but the one that makes sense. First, we were told it was about racism when Lisa Helps did the blog post misquoting Gordon Price. And now we're told it's about housing affordability. And no, it's not going to be affordable. It's going to be attainable, whatever that means. It means, you know, can you get it if you have enough money? Well, everything's attainable that way, isn't it? Anyway, 250-386-1161. Ron from Maryland is up. Ron, I think it's Friday, so it's a pop culture update, right?
It is, Adam, and today we're honoring the legacy and life of Olivia Newton-John, who passed away Monday at the age of 73.
You know, I was watching clips from Greece because, of course, they were all over television and all over social media, and I have to say it is quite amazing what Hollywood audiences were conditioned to accept as being high school students. How old was she when Greece was shot? How old was John Travolta? They were a lot older than high school students, weren't they?
I think they were.
All right. Sorry, I didn't mean to sandbag you there by asking a question you didn't know the answer to, but I was just remarking on that because it became a cultural touchstone, and it still is even today.
Yes. It's become a classic since its release in 1978.
All right. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have jumped in. Continue your pop culture update.
Well, her first big hits included Let Me Be There, I Honestly Love You, and Please, Mr. Please, which were big hits on the country charts. Then she had a couple of hits on the pop charts, A Little More Love, which is one of my favorites, and then Hollywood came calling with her role in Grease, and then she starred in Xanadu, an excellent movie. I'm going to watch that tonight.
Yeah.
And then she had another movie out which didn't do too well, despite a hit song from there, that was Two of a Kind. And then Physical, which she did not want to release at first, but then decided to make a video about exercise. And the video became a big hit as well.
Yeah, the song wasn't actually about exercise in the beginning, was it? But that's okay. We'll just leave that one by the wayside.
Yes. In 1992, it was announced that she was battling breast cancer. So it's happened for the past 30 years, up to the end on Monday. Olivia will be missed, but will always be remembered for the great music and all the great movies she did, and some that may have been not so great later on.
Ron, that's a great pop culture update. Thank you, as always. Calling in from the great state of Maryland, all right?
Thank you, Adam.
All right. You have a great day, Ron. We'll talk to you later. 250-386-1161, *1070, a free call on your wireless device. Go to Dennis. Dennis, welcome to Open Lines. You're on the air.
Yeah, Adam, before I start, I just want to thank you for what you do, because if I was doing it, I'd be leaping out of the window one day.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm an elbows up debate kind of guy, and I think there's a lot of other politically inclined folks out there who are also elbows up debate kind of people. I know that those of you who are observing the back and forth and the rousing debate might be under the impression about how awful and acrimonious and horrible it gets. It's a lot of it is kind of like WWE wrestling. There's that element of operatic discourse. There's that element of theatricality that could be there. I don't take any of it personally. And I'll tell you, the ones hurling it at me, they don't really mean it. They're just playing games. It's like dressing up in Halloween costumes or cosplaying. So I don't really hold it against them that much either. It's all good.
But what I really phoned about is all this environmental nonsense we hear here, how we're going to save the world. I mean, we all know the environment's going to hell.
Yeah.
But Canada, I checked, we do 700 million metric tons of CO2 a year.
716 was my last count, but yeah.
The 3,022 coal-fired hydro plants in China.
Yeah.
0.6 billion metric.
Yeah. No, it's other jurisdictions with more than a billion people in them are outpacing us. Like, they're in another galaxy in terms of scale. But the argument is always, should we measure it per capita where we're bigger, or should we measure it per nation where they're bigger? And of course, you're going to get disagreement. So we can't even see eye to eye on that.
Well, I know. But, you know, when people tell me, oh, we use a lot in Canada, I go, you live in Calgary in February and see if you're not going to turn the furnace on. We live above the 49th. Parallel.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. I know somebody actually who moved from here in Victoria where they had been staying to Alberta, and they got this, you know, the rent was super low, and then they realized that it's like $600 a month to heat the place during the winter. It all adds up.
Yeah, we were in Hawaii in February. In the morning, opened the door, locked the screen door, went into the living room, locked the screen door, opened the sliding door. All you do is have fans on. 30 degrees, it costs nothing. But, you know, if we could put natural gas into those 3,022 coal-fired plants, 55% cleaner burning fuel. That's 4 billion metric tons of CO2 that wouldn't go into the atmosphere.
Yep. No, I'm a believer in that. I think that coal-fired electricity has had its day, and while we're always going to need metallurgical coal, and we're always going to need some source of that particular fossil fuel, I think that we could be smarter in terms of how we're using it. And if I had my way, we'd have Canadian natural gas having people with good-paying jobs here powering folks in China who deserve lights and heat and technology just like everybody else deserves those things in their lives. And I think everybody would be a little better off. For any number of reasons, though, it didn't shake out that way. So we got coal making electricity on the other side of the Pacific while the gas sits in the ground over here. We don't get the money. They don't get the money. Nobody seems to win per se. And on we go.
Yeah, a lot of it's to do with these environmental wingnuts.
Well, a lot of them mean well, but a lot of them don't realize how complicated the system is and how often their intuitions can betray them is what I find.
Yeah, okay. Well, and like I say again, Adam, thank you. I enjoy it, but I start screaming sometimes. You.
So do I, Dennis. So do I. We all do. And you know what? That's okay. It's okay to be a human being and to scream and to get that catharsis out every so often. And afterwards, I feel better. You feel better. Everybody feels better. And maybe we understand, even if we don't agree, maybe we understand each other just a little better.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right. You have a great day, Dennis. You take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now. Have a good day. Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
Good. Well, the answer is right in front of us.
Yeah.
The cheap... Non-belief. GPs, what are the complaints? Paperwork, overhead. We have subsidy programs to help them with the overhead of the offices and stuff like that. As for paperwork and administration, we stick government employees in there. That's another way of subsidizing. That's the way of filling the NDP coffers with voters. If there's one deal that John should do before he leaves office is deal with the medical system. He owes his life to it. He has a GP. And without that GP, he wouldn't have had his cancer discovered. And without the medical system, who knows?
Well.
So this is the one thing that he should be doing. And if he goes to Ottawa with a plan, and he's already said, we don't know what we do because we don't know how much money we got. Do you think you're going to get your allowance? No. Go to Ottawa with a plan. Maybe you'll get your allowance then.
All right, Kevin. I'm out of time. That'll be our final word for this segment. We're going to take a quick break. Up next, Victoria seeing a rapid increase in reports of sexual assault, even while the crime severity index came down 20 points from 2020 to 2021. We'll talk with the executive director, Victoria Sexual Assault Center, right after this.